The deal to allow for the release of hostages and prisoners is extended.
We'd certainly like to see even that extension extended further until all the hostages are released. That's really the goal here. Get all the hostages home with their families where they belong.
Plus, some of the children being held hostage have come home, but they face a long road ahead.
The condition is not normal. There are different reactions. One will cry, another will speak about different things. One will wet his bed, another won't. We will be afraid to go out where they're from the safe room.
And later, what could block tens of billions of dollars meant for Ukraine? And a look ahead to COP28. Today is Tuesday, November 28th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas has been extended for another 2 days. That story was just developing as Monday's program was being produced. Reuters' Lauren Anthony brings us up to speed.
The agreement lengthens a 4-day ceasefire after 7 weeks of warfare, which has seen thousands killed and laid waste to the Palestinian enclave. Hamas also confirmed the extension. There was no immediate comment from Israel. The release of 11 more Israeli hostages seized by Hamas during its October 7th assault on southern Israel was confirmed on Monday, as dozens of Gazans rushed to get supplies from aid rations distributed by the UN on Monday. Many described the dire living conditions that they expect to worsen if war resumes. Raider Mohammed Jamal al-Jaburi is one of them.
We wish that the truce would be permanent and people would go back to their lives and to see each other. People have lost their families and relatives, and we are not able to reach our families. We don't know who we lost and who was still alive. We are coming here to try and get some clothes for our children, because we left everything in our house. Children are wearing summer clothes. This is not right. God willing, the truce will be extended and will stay in place. We don't want more war. This is enough. This is so tough on us.
On Sunday, Hamas freed 17 Israelis, including a 4-year-old Israeli-American girl, and Israel freed 39 teenage Palestinian prisoners. The truce, agreed last week, is the first halt in fighting since Hamas attacked Israel, when 1,200 people were killed and 240 hostages were taken back into Gaza. In Jerusalem, Israeli Anat Errol is also advocating for a pause in fighting.
I'm against all violence, and I really hope that there will be ceasefire, and I really hope that it will continue to be ceasefire, because violence is not a solution for anything. I mean, I know that those terrorists are like horrible, like they are. I can't even say there. They need to, of course, personally they need to be punished, but not all the other people in Gaza need to be punished.
In response to the October 7th attack, Israel has bombarded the Gaza Strip and mounted a ground offensive in the north. As of Monday, Gaza health authorities say some 14,800 Palestinians have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced.
That's Reuters' Lauren Anthony reporting for us. As we now know, the ceasefire agreement that allowed for the release of some of the hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th in exchange for Palestinians held in Israeli jails has been extended for 48 hours, with 10 more hostages expected to be released on Tuesday night in Israel. In Washington on Monday, the White House welcomed the news of the deal's extension and expressed optimism at further cooperation. John Kirby is spokesperson for the National Security Council.
We'd certainly like to see even that extension extended further until all the hostages are released. That's really the goal here, get all the hostages home with their families where they belong. And we, you know, however long that could take.
However, Israel has made it clear that its military goal of removing Hamas from power in Gaza has not yet been met and that the fighting will resume. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research and foreign policy at the Brookings Institution.
There are two separate problems. The long-term end to the fighting is going to require the dismantlement of Hamas, probably not in any realistic way the complete elimination of all of its fighters or capabilities or ideas. But the top leadership has to go. Hamas's ability to rule Gaza has to go. And I don't see that as having been changed in any way, shape, or form by the current pause in the fighting.
The truce, however, is fragile. On Tuesday, each side accused the other of breaking the agreement. Palestinians denounced what they called truce violations by the occupier, and an AFP journalist saw an Israeli tank fire three times in the Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. The Israeli military described the shelling as warning shots, saying a tank fired as suspected militants approached army positions. At least one person was hurt, according to the AFP reporter who witnessed the incident. The Israeli military, meanwhile, alleged that three explosive devices were detonated near its forces in the northern Gaza Strip, violating the framework of the operational pause. In one of the locations, terrorists also opened fire at the troops, who responded with fire. A number of soldiers were lightly injured during the incidents, the IDF said. The deal to release hostages and prisoners is important, as is the agreement to extend the deal further, releasing more people from captivity on both sides of the border. It's important diplomatically, it's important politically, and it's important because it allows for humanitarian aid to get through to where it is needed. It's also deeply important to the families of the hostages and prisoners who were released. Linda Gradstein has that side of the story from Jerusalem.
It seemed an entire nation held its breath while waiting for Hamas to free the Israeli children it held hostage. Many Israelis cried as they watched each hostage released over the past few days. On Monday, mediator Qatar announced that Israel and Hamas agreed to extend a ceasefire for two more days, raising hopes among Israelis that more people, including children that Hamas had taken hostage on October 7th, would be released. Ohad Mundar, a thin boy who likes to play with Rubik's Cubes, turned nine while being held captive by Hamas with his mother, Karen. He was reunited with his father in the hospital. His cousin, Meirav Raviv, says that Ohad has lost weight but seems healthy and happy to belatedly celebrate his ninth birthday with his friends at the hospital.
But they were talking and laughing and like normal kids. It wasn't that easy for him, but Karen said that he behaved very nice. There were a time that he was crying, and also when he came back, I mean, the tears when he saw a sensitive movie or something that someone told him something, so it was emotional. But I hope he will get back to normal as soon as possible.
Israel says Hamas captured 40 children out of a total of 240 hostages. An official from Qatar said that 10 of the children are under the control of other militant groups and that it's not clear if Hamas can find them. The freed children will have to work through the trauma of their ordeal, psychiatrists say. Some, like 4-year-old Abigail Idan, saw their parents killed. Her father was holding her when a Hamas militant shot him. Dr. Yuval Bloch is a child and adolescent psychiatrist.
The condition is not normal. There are different reactions. One will cry, another will speak about different things. One will wet his bed, another will be afraid to go out where they're from the safe room, because that's the only safe place, or another won't agree to go into the safe room because the memories of the same room are the memories of death and danger.
As part of the ceasefire deal, Israel released three Palestinian prisoners, all women or minors, for every hostage who was freed. Among the released prisoners was Fatima Shaheen, convicted of trying to stab an Israeli settler. Shaheen's father, Ismail, says he is happy his daughter was freed, but concerned about the terrible conditions in Gaza.
We are happy that she was
released, but only slightly so, because we cannot ignore the dire conditions in Gaza, where thousands have been killed. It is not suitable for us to be happy at this time. It is not suitable for us to be happy.
The Israeli families say that the reunions with their children released from Hamas captivity are bittersweet because there are still so many remaining hostages. They say they will not rest until every family is reunited. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The Biden administration is telling Israel that when it does resume its ground campaign in Gaza, it must operate with greater precision. The AP's Donna Warder reports.
The Biden administration wants Israel to avoid more large-scale civilian casualties or mass displacement like what occurred before the current temporary ceasefire. Israel's ground campaign is aimed at eradicating the Hamas militant group, but there's been international and domestic pressure about the rising Palestinian death toll, which is at more than 13,000 people. Meanwhile, the State Department says Secretary of State Antony Blinken plans to return to the Middle East this week as the U.S. hopes to find a way to further extend the ceasefire and get more hostages released. Donna Water, Washington.
We just heard how Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to head back to the Middle East soon. As VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden reports, CIA Director William Burns is in Doha now. The chief of the main U.S. spy agency is on the road for talks on what happens next in the fight between Israel and Hamas.
U.S. officials rarely talk about travel plans for CIA Director William Burns, but a U.S. official confirms to VOA Burns is currently in Doha. The high-level talks, according to the official, are focused on the Israel-Hamas conflict and on the up to 175 hostages still being held by Hamas. Paul Piller, a former CIA officer who now teaches at Georgetown University, tells VOA the goal seems to be to keep the current pause in fighting in place.
The objective of the administration at the moment clearly is to try to extend the truce or ceasefire as long as possible and get as many hostages released as much as possible.
This is at least the second time this month Burns has traveled to the Middle East, following the October 7th terror attack by Hamas. Earlier this month, U.S. officials said the CIA director visited several countries in the region to discuss the Israeli response. Piller says it's not surprising, given Burns' background.
He is a highly accomplished and very much respected, both at home and abroad, diplomat. So he has become, for the Biden administration, a very useful general-purpose diplomatic troubleshooter on matters that may have little or nothing to do with his day job as the CIA director.
As for Qatar, it's played a key role in facilitating talks between Israel and Hamas, most recently helping to negotiate the extended pause in fighting in exchange for the release of 50 of the Hamas-held hostages and 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Flashpoint, a global crisis from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Time now to check in on the crisis in Ukraine. We'll find out why tens of billions of dollars in aid are in jeopardy in a moment. First, though, this update from Kyiv. On Tuesday, the Russian military conducted shelling of the Dnipropetrovsk region and the city of Zaporizhia. In addition, Russian forces continue their offensive operations around Avdiivka, but weather conditions are forcing both Russian and Ukrainian forces to slow down their ground attacks. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
On Tuesday morning, the Russian military conducted an artillery attack on a residential building in the Dnipropetrovsk region. Authorities say one civilian was killed and two injured in the city of Nikopol. The Russian military also struck an enterprise facility in Zaporizhia, injuring one person. A preliminary investigation indicates a ballistic missile was used. Ukrainian military officials also report that Russian forces continue offensive operations in six directions in the Avdiivka area, and heavy fighting continues near the Avdiivka coke and chemical plant. The Institute for the Study of War finds that Russian forces did not achieve significant advances, and the Ukrainian General Staff states that Ukrainian troops repelled more than 30 Russian attacks in a 13-kilometer zone around Avdiivka. A Ukrainian military spokesman says Russian troops continue their ground assaults in groups of 10 to 20 people. Russian sources report that Russian troops captured the entire industrial zone southeast of Avdiivka and advanced to the southeastern outskirts of the city. Despite difficult weather conditions, both Russian and Ukrainian forces continue ground attacks across Ukraine, however, at a slightly slower pace due to snow and poor visibility. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Hungary is threatening to block tens of billions of dollars of European aid for Ukraine and veto its EU membership bid amid a spiraling dispute between Brussels and Budapest. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the EU Council president traveled to Hungary on Monday in a bid to calm relations ahead of a crucial December summit.
Hungary has long been a thorn in the side of the European Union, and now, as the campaign is underway for next June's European elections, the Hungarian government has launched a personal attack against European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, putting up billboards showing her alongside Alex Soros, the son of the liberal Hungarian-born financier George Soros, another favourite target. The slogan reads, "Let's not dance to their tunes." Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán stepped up his attacks on the EU in an address to his Fidesz Party Congress this month.
I am convinced that today in Brussels, Europe is being destroyed and led to its ruin.
European Council President Charles Michel visited Orbán for talks Monday. Neither spoke to the media. The EU is continuing to withhold around $24 billion from the bloc's post-COVID stimulus fund over concerns about the rule of law in Hungary, including the independence of the judiciary and freedom of the press. In a letter to Michel last week, Orbán reportedly threatened to block a $50 billion EU aid package for Ukraine. He also said he would veto Ukraine's future membership in the bloc unless EU leaders agree to review their entire strategy of support for Kyiv. Analysts say the policy could backfire. Peter Kreko is an analyst at the Political Capital think tank in Budapest.
Orbán is increasingly isolated within the European Union, and it hurts. It hurts not only symbolically, but it hurts economically as well. The Hungarian economy is not in a very good shape, and the lack of the EU funds and the frozen EU funds due to rule of law concerns, but also due to the government's outlier position in the Russia-Ukraine issue and also its EU bashing clearly played an important role in freezing these funds.
Brussels released $1 billion of the frozen funds last week in an effort to overcome Hungary's objections, but it's not clear if that will be enough. EU heads of state are due to meet December 14th to discuss opening formal talks on Ukraine's membership application. Hungary has said there is no way those talks can proceed with a country at war and has urged Kyiv to seek peace talks with Moscow. Ukraine has said it will not open negotiations until Russian forces leave its territory. Any blocking of EU aid or veto of Ukraine's membership application would raise the stakes further in the increasingly bitter dispute between Budapest and Brussels. Analysts say Orbán could be emboldened by the recent election of like-minded leaders in Slovakia and the Netherlands, who have also voiced scepticism of EU support for Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
On now to North Korea. We reported here last week that Pyongyang launched what they said was a spy satellite in violation of UN security resolutions. On Tuesday, they claimed to have received their first photos from that satellite. Reuters' Gabe Singer has more.
North Korean state media said Tuesday its leader Kim Jong-un received photos of, quote, major target regions in the United States, taken by its recently launched spy satellite. KCNA said the batch includes photos of the White House, Pentagon, and U.S. aircraft carriers. Seoul officials say the North's claims could not be confirmed as it has not released the photos. Contention over the satellite spilled over into a snap meeting of the UN Security Council a day earlier, which was called to convene after last week's launch, following dozens of ballistic missile tests over the past 20 months. It resulted in a rare, direct, public exchange between the U.S. and North Korea. Here's U.S. Ambassador Linda Thompson-Greenfield.
The DPRK is unabashedly trying to advance its nuclear weapons delivery systems by testing ballistic missile technology in clear violation of this council's resolutions.
In unplanned remarks at the end of the meeting, Thompson Greenfield rejected Pyongyang's claims that its launches were defensive actions in response to military provocation by the U.S. and its allies, but extended an offer for dialogue, quote, without preconditions.
The United States is just threatening us with a nuclear weapon.
In response, North Korea's Ambassador Kim Song defended what he called his country's, quote, legitimate right to develop its weapon systems on par with the U.S. North Korea has been under U.N. sanctions for its ballistic missile and nuclear programs for nearly two decades. But for the past several years, the U.N. Security Council has been divided on how to deal with Pyongyang, with veto powers Russia and China arguing against further sanctions. Washington says such protection from Moscow and Beijing only emboldens North Korea to continue to flout UN resolutions.
Gabe Singer of Reuters with that report. And finally today, the climate crisis. Nearly 200 countries will gather in Dubai on Thursday for this year's United Nations climate negotiations, known as COP28. My colleague Lori London spoke with Michael Gerard. He's a professor of environmental law at Columbia University about one of the serious global implications of the climate crisis.
The World Bank has estimated that by 2050, there will be 200 million climate refugees. We're seeing extreme heat worsening, flooding, weather events that are deadly and growing worse every year. There will be obviously issues that will make places potentially unlivable. What are the implications of that kind of massive number of climate refugees?
There's a huge disconnect between the number of people displaced by climate change that we're expecting and the policies of any government to deal with that. There's no legal structure to cope with people who are displaced by climate change. They are not technically considered refugees within international law. So countries don't have an obligation to take them in. There are negotiations about that, but they haven't gotten very far. So we're already seeing in the United States and Europe and other places tremendous resistance to people trying to get through the border. Large numbers of people trying to get in tend to lead to the strengthening of right-wing movements. And the people who can't get in are subject to enormous suffering.
And is it already happening to some degree?
Many of the people who are coming in from Latin America are coming in because of persistent drought and agricultural failures. You know, it's the drug wars get mostly attention, but a lot of it is worsened by climate change. The Syrian civil war was worsened by climate change. A lot of people coming up from Africa. So yes, this is already happening.
What sorts of things will make their habitats unlivable?
Sea level rise is certainly going to have one major impact. Drought. Parts of Africa, the Sahel region, have suffered persistent drought. And if it's not possible to grow food, lack of water is going to be another impact. And in the years to come, there are increasingly distressing projections about extreme heat. Already we've had unprecedented heat waves, especially during what should be the winter in the southern hemisphere and in other parts of the world. So there will come a time when some parts of the world are literally uninhabitable for periods of time unless you have air conditioning. And a lot of these places don't have much air conditioning, so that could be another driver of large-scale migration.
And you mentioned conflict and unrest. Would forced migration due to climate change, could that potentially be leading to further conflict that we're already seeing so many of around the world, or could it exacerbate those that are already happening?
Climate change is seen as a threat multiplier, that where you have political instability, it makes it worse. That has certainly happened in places like Sudan, Syria, and other places in the world. It puts more people on the move. It puts greater pressure on public services, on food supply. It makes people angry. There are many different mechanisms, but yes, it makes the situation worse. If you have people who are forcibly displaced from their homes and there's no habitable place for them to go, that leads to a very serious situation. People are not going to quietly let their children starve.
That's VOA's Lori London, host of Issues in the News here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Michael Gerard, a professor of environmental law at Columbia University in New York. And that's going to wrap up today's program. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Carriage.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.